Lecture 4, The Labor Market and Wages.
One way to think about the economy is to focus on goods that are bought and sold in the economy. That's the sort of supply and demand framework we've been looking at in the last couple of lectures. But it's equally valid and equally sensible to look at the economy and to think of not of things being bought and sold, but just to think of everything being produced, to think of the labor that's going into that production. As one economist put it, the economy is what happens when 120 million people get up and go to work in the morning. It's not just what's produced, it's also the labor market. And with this lecture, we're going to shift over, and instead of talking about the goods market and supply and demand for goods, we'll talk about labor. Where do people work in the U.S. economy? I think it's often interesting and a little shocking to some people to think about the size of different employers. There's often a sense out there that the good jobs are with really big companies, that good jobs happen with big firms, and that's where you get security, and that's where people have their careers. Well, when you think about some big companies the last 20 years or so, some companies like IBM or General Motors, it's not so obvious that having a job there really has been all that secure. But it's interesting to think about the distribution of jobs and where people work. Think about these different groups of employers. First of all, employers that hire fewer than 20 people. Those employers who hire fewer than 20 people employ 26% of all the workers in the U.S. labor markets. They employ almost a fourth. The employers who hire between 20 and 99 employees hire 29% of all workers in the U.S. labor market. So if you put those two categories together, then employers that hire fewer than 100 people hire 55%, or more than half of all the workers in the U.S. economy. If we go up a size, 100 to 499 workers, that group hires another 25% of all the workers in the economy. 500 to 999 workers, those employers hire 7%, and employers with more than 1,000 employees, the IBMs, the General Motors of this world, they hire only 13% of the employees in the U.S. economy. Now, of course, all the large and small employers are interrelated. I remember somebody once said to me, sort of stuck with me, you got to remember that when you think about small companies, what most of the small companies do is sell stuff to big companies. And so I'm not sort of saying here that we should ignore the big companies and just look at the small companies or anything like that. But nonetheless, in thinking about where people work, it's interesting to me that those really big employers, the giant companies that we've all heard of, employ such a small fraction, only perhaps 13% of the U.S. labor force. The key to thinking about labor markets, key to thinking about all markets as far as we're concerned here, is going to be, repeat after me, supply and demand. In this case, however, supply and demand comes in a slightly different context, and one that's worth thinking about just a little bit. In this case, when we talk about the price of labor, we're going to be talking about the wage that people are paid, not the price as in the price we think of a good or service. To economists, the wage is just another kind of price. It's the price in the labor market. And when we think about quantities bought and sold, instead of thinking about quantities of cars or clothes or familiar things like that, we're going to be thinking about the quantity of hours that people choose to work. It's also important to remember that we're all kind of used to the idea, I think, that households are demanders, because we think of ourselves as buying goods and services. But in the labor market, remember, households are the suppliers. Households are the ones providing the labor into the market. And firms are the ones demanding that labor when they make their hiring decisions. If we can keep those terms straight, then the use of supply and demand is going to be pretty much analogous between the markets that we talked about before and this market. Let's think about, again, working through demand and supply, and working through them in sort of a straightforward kind of way. We can rely some on what we did in the earlier lectures. Again, if we think about demand for labor, remember, demand for labor comes from firms. And demand, once again, is going to be a relationship between the price, in this case the wage, and the quantity of labor demanded. And just as before, a higher price meant less quantity demanded, we would believe that typically a higher wage is going to mean that firms will demand less labor than before. Well, why is that? Well, on an intuitive basis, again, it ought to make sense. If you think about yourself running a small business and saying, or a big business, and say, well, the cost of all the labor just went up, you're going to try and hire some fewer people and find some ways to conserve on that particular cost. You'll think about trying to invest maybe in some machinery, or think about ways of reorganizing work in a way that you'll be able to get by with less than you did before.
Well, how much of that will you do? Of course, it depends on the job. It depends how easy it is to replace labor. It depends on the situation in a lot of different ways. So, trick question, like the trick question we had before. What changes the demand for labor? And the answer is, again, not the price of labor, not the wage. Because demand for labor is a whole relationship between all the possible wages and all the quantities of labor demanded. So, price of labor is already built in, if you think about it in that way. What does change the demand for labor would be something like new technology. And in fact, there's of course an argument going back several centuries over whether or not new technology is good or bad for labor. A common argument going back to the early 19th century is that technology is bad for labor because it displaces people from their jobs. And people are replaced by machines, if you want to think of it in that way. A converse argument is that technology is good for labor because workers who work with technology and have technology available to them and work with machinery and equipment can produce more. And if you can produce more, then you're going to get paid a higher wage. Now, I know that out there in the real world, sometimes this is thought of as an argument that still goes on today. But for the purposes of economists, this argument's been settled for a long time. If it was true that new technology replaced labor on an ongoing basis rather than in a few individual cases, heck, after all the new technology we've had in the 19th and 20th century, there probably would be hardly any jobs left. I mean, we would have replaced everybody at this point. It seems much more plausible that over long periods of time, that although technology certainly does cause disruption, it increases the demand for labor also, and it makes people able to work more and earn more, help labor be more productive. In the end, the demand for labor from firms is going to depend on the productivity of workers. After all, if you're a firm and you're thinking about how much to pay someone, or you're a worker thinking about how much to work for, if a firm underpays its workers, it pays them less than they produce, then some other employer is going to come along and hire those people away. Because after all, they'll be able to pay them more and still make money off the deal. On the other hand, if a firm overpays its workers and pays them more than they produce, that firm is presumably going to go broke sooner or later. So you can sort of think of productivity as determining how much firms are willing to pay their workers, and competition between firms as providing some discipline so that at least for long periods of time you don't see gross overpaying or gross underpaying. Let's think about supply in the labor market. Supply in the labor market, remember, comes from households. They're the ones supplying labor into the market. And again, supply is a relationship. It's a relationship between price and quantity. In this case, the price is the wage, and the quantity is the quantity supplied of labor. And in general, if you think about it in terms of our basic graphs, you would say that the higher wage is going to meet a higher quantity of labor supplied. Because after all, as people get paid more and more, they're going to be more and more eager to work. Now, why is that? Well, on some intuitive level, work becomes more attractive if you're getting paid more for it. It's sort of going to make more sense to give up more time for work. However, it's worth saying that this attraction is going to vary a lot depending on who different people are. There's a group of workers who labor economists, with their standard sensitivity, refer to as prime age males. And prime age males refers to men between the ages of about 34 and 55 who pretty much, if they have a job, work full time. At least that's the tradition in our society. Now, those men, if you pay them a higher wage, they actually don't work very many more hours because, after all, they're already working full-time. And most of them are not going to race out and get an extra job or work nights because they got an extra wage. However, there are a lot of folks, secondary earners in families, which, you know, used to be women most of the time, but not so much anymore, or teenagers, who do have a lot of sensitivity to the wage. And if they get a higher wage, they're much more likely to go out and look for a job than otherwise. So we sort of think about how much does the quantity of labor supplied adjust to the wage. Depends a lot on who the worker is. But in general, we think there might be some increase or some increased willingness. Trick question again. I should be getting used to this particular trick question. What is it that changes the supply of labor? And again, the answer is not the price, not the wage. The wage is already built into what we mean by supply of labor. If we're going to shift the supply of labor, we need to say that at a certain wage, at every given wage, more labor will be supplied than before, or less labor will be supplied than before. And in that sense, what would shift the supply of labor might be something like just a larger population. larger population might mean, for example, that at any given wage, there would be more workers available than there were before. Or shifts in demographics and social trends, like the trend toward more women entering the paid labor force. Again, that would be a trend where at any given wage, all up and down the list of possible wages, you would expect more people to be in the labor force because of that change. We then combine supply and demand, just in the same way that we did think combine supply and demand in the goods market. Again, there's going to be a situation where there's going to be one wage where the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded are equal to each other, that equilibrium wage. And if you think about it, the same logic holds true as held true before. If the wage is too low, then you're in a situation where, well, if the wage is too low, not very many people are willing to supply labor, because after all, the wage isn't enough to make it worthwhile for them. Businesses want to hire a lot of people, but since it's not worth it, the businesses are going to be out there trying to hire, and as they do that, they will slowly drive the wage up toward the equilibrium. If the wage started off too high, on the other hand, what one might expect, although we'll have to come back to whether this really happens later on, is that lots of people would be willing to work at the high wage, but businesses wouldn't be willing to hire very many people. And as a result, since lots of people want to work, but not too many people want to hire, the wage would gradually be pushed down toward the equilibrium level. In general, this simple model of supply and demand would say that we work towards some kind of a level where the quantity demanded and the quantity supplied are equal to each other, and thus, everyone who wants to work at the going wage is able to work. Everyone who wants to hire someone at the going wage is able to hire them. And with supply and demand in balance, we don't have a shortage of labor, we don't have a surplus of labor, we just have things in balance. And because they're in balance, and there are no shortages and there are no surpluses, we would call this an efficient situation. Again, efficient doesn't mean good, efficient doesn't mean bad. Efficient just means that there's not waste in this situation. Now, I hope this framework is fairly straightforward, because after all, it's the same framework we used before. But to try and make it more vivid, what I'd like to do is spend the rest of this lecture talking about applying this framework to some common policy issues that come up, and using the insights from those policy issues accordingly. First of all, let me say the most obvious policy issue we might talk about here would be unemployment. I mean, that's, after all, a leading issue in the labor market. But right now we're doing microeconomics. We want to look at particular things that affect groups of workers or groups of employers. And unemployment is sort of a macroeconomic issue. So we'll save unemployment for later, for Lecture 12 in particular, and some of the lectures that follow, and stick to some more microeconomic issues at this point. First issue I'd like to talk about is the minimum wage, much in the news lately. Anyone who's not familiar with what the minimum wage is, the minimum wage simply says that people must receive a minimum amount per hour when they work. And presumably the reason we have a minimum wage is that we believe otherwise, if there wasn't a minimum wage, people would be paid less than that. And we believe that that lower wage would be too low, value judgment. And so we're going to insert this minimum wage, and we're going to guarantee that wages do not fall below that level. So a minimum wage is just a standard example of a price floor, just as we talked about before in terms of price floors with farmers' wages. In this case, the supplier of labor is the one who benefits from that price floor. A little history of the minimum wage. The U.S. passed its minimum wage at the national level for the first time in 1938. There had been some state-level minimum wages that passed in the few decades before that. But 1938 is, of course, an interesting time in the U.S. economic history. We're kind of in the second big hit of the Great Depression, a deep, deep recession in 1937 and 1938. We've just experienced a terrible economic downturn. Unemployment has been 25%. Wages have been falling. And at that time, there is a powerful argument to be made that somehow, in that situation, it really wasn't right or fair for employers to take advantage of workers who were literally just desperate and starving. There was also a sense that a man who works full-time, and then it really was a man working full-time, should earn enough to support his family. And that somehow the government had some role to play in assuring that that would work out. Now, all of that makes sense enough in terms of rhetoric, it's perhaps also worth saying that that rhetoric doesn't tell the whole story. If you look at the voting for and against the minimum wage in 1938, one of the things you discover is that the northern senators and congressmen voted almost unanimously for the minimum wage, and the southern senators and congressmen voted almost unanimously against the minimum wage. Why was that? Wages were much, much lower in the South. The minimum wage was basically set at a level above southern wages, but below northern wages. So the northerners were really worried during the Depression that business was going to move to the South to take advantage of the low wages in the South. And because of that, they wanted to prevent the South from attracting business in the North, and that's one of the reasons they were so willing to pass the minimum wage, to disable competition from the South in that way. One of the results of the minimum wage, then, was when we think about unemployment from that time, almost all of it was poor southern workers, particularly black southern workers, who were displaced because their low-wage jobs were now illegal. You couldn't pay that little. And many of them migrated to the north at that point. So, when you think about the justice argument, yeah, there's a justice argument. Yeah, it has some weight. But you also shouldn't leave out the people trying to protect their own back, people trying to be selfish in their own ways. In economic terms, a minimum wage is just a price floor. It's a price floor that presumably is set above the equilibrium. If it's not above the equilibrium, there's no point to passing it in the first place. So, what do we expect of a price floor? We expect that the quantity supplied of labor will be a little higher and the quantity demanded will be down a little bit. As the demand for labor drops, and particularly we're talking the demand for low-skilled labor here, we would expect some increase in unemployment among unskilled workers. And sort of standard result that, drawing on lots and lots of different studies over time, is that a 10% rise in the minimum wage leads to maybe a 1 or 2% increase in unemployment for poor, low-skilled workers. Now, that result is really small. And in fact, it's so small that there are a number of studies that don't find, statistically speaking, any particular connection at all between higher minimum wage and unemployment. And many of you are probably familiar, there's been a lot of controversy the last few years about minimum wage studies. This isn't the place to delve into all of that. But I would say that when you start talking about a 10% rise in the minimum wage or a 20% rise in the minimum wage and the effect is just 1 or 2% on unemployment, 1 or 2% is not a large amount. And that's unemployment for a particular group of the market. So the overall numbers, once you start working them out, are such that it's quite possible to raise the minimum wage some amount without seeing very much of an overall increase in unemployment at all. Now, this is, of course, true for the U.S. minimum wage. The U.S. minimum wage has historically been set at a pretty low level. Roughly speaking, it's been about 40% of the median wage for the economy as a whole. If you go over to France, where they set their minimum wage much, much higher, it probably has a much bigger effect on creating unemployment. But again, that makes perfect sense in the supply and demand framework. If you have a price floor and it's pretty darn close to what the wage would be anyway, then it probably doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference. But if you make your price floor higher and higher and higher and higher, then you're going to have more and more of an effect on unemployment. In fact, there are some proposals now, like there was one recently in the city I live in Minneapolis and St. Paul, where city employees of the city, where there was a rule that they were going to have to be paid what the advocates of this called a living wage, advocacy value judgment again there, and the living wage was going to be something like $11 or $12 an hour. Now, that's a large number. That's not like the minimum wage at $5.15 an hour. And if you were to do something like that, my guess is you would have real effects on unemployment that everybody would see. But at the current levels, it's just not a huge effect. Now, let's think about that price floor and think about the story in the 1930s and what's going on there. What are the problems with the minimum wage if we think about that logic of you should earn enough to support a family and things like that? First problem, what if you've got more than one worker in a family? After all, an awful lot of families these days have at least two earners, and so is it really right to say these days that one person should be able to support a family, or should we say that two people have to support a family, and that the minimum wage thus should be set at half? Or how do we figure out for families that have one wage earner and families that have two wage earners what fairness would be? If we think about teenage workers with teenage jobs, is it really right to say that a teenage worker, perhaps one without kids, should be earning enough to support a family? somehow the claim of justice there seems a little weaker to me, that someone who's working to, you know, buy nice things for themselves over the summer should have to be in a situation where they can earn enough to support a family. There's also a question about who is unemployed and how many people are unemployed. If we think about 1938, when unemployment is 25%, there are very few jobs out there. That's one situation where unemployment exists. But today, when unemployment is around 4.5% or 5%, it's not clear to me that we have the same dire need to guarantee everyone that they'll get paid a certain amount. So when we sort of think about the claim of the minimum wage made in the 1930s and the claim of the minimum wage now, things have changed in our society in terms of who is expected to earn how much is reasonable for them to earn, and they've changed in ways where the justice claims of the minimum wage are, at least to me, a little bit squishier than they might be before. Now again, as I tried to argue in the previous lecture, our point here is not to say that having decent wages for low-skilled workers is a bad goal. In fact, I think it's a perfectly good goal. But it's a perfectly good goal which can be accomplished in a variety of different ways, and the minimum wage is only one of those ways. For example, one possibility for raising earnings for unskilled workers would be to reduce the supply of unskilled workers. How do you reduce the supply of unskilled workers? You do better education and you do job training. If you do education and job training, presumably two things happen. One is that all those people you've educated and trained now can get better jobs because they're educated and trained. But the other interesting part is that those people who you've educated and trained are now, there's a lesser number of low-skilled workers than there was before. And so if someone was to go out and try and hire low-skilled workers, they would discover that there was sort of a shortage of them. And a shortage of low-skilled workers is a good thing if you care about their wages. It'll tend to drive up their wages. So by reducing the number of low-skilled workers through training, you don't just help those who are trained, you help those who are not trained as well. Another alternative method would be you could, of course, subsidize firms to hire unskilled workers in one way or another. You could give firms some sort of a tax break or other bonus. That would be working on the demand side of the labor market. You could also subsidize the low-paid workers directly. One way that we do that in current policy is through something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, or the EITC. The idea of the Earned Income Tax Credit is just that when you work a certain number of hours, and if you have a family, you have to have a family in order to get the Earned Income Tax Credit, then when you fill out your taxes, you get a big break on your taxes. Not a huge break, because you're mainly talking poor workers here. But effectively, it works out like getting a subsidy where they add about 10 or 15% to your hourly wage. Now, because that happens through the tax code, it doesn't have any effect on the employer. There's no reason for the employer to trim back on their low-skilled workers or to say, this is costing me more, I need to fire some folks, because they are not paying it. The subsidy is coming through the tax code instead. Now, you know, reducing the supply of unskilled workers through training, subsidizing firms to hire unskilled workers, subsidizing low-paid workers directly through the Earned Income Tax Credit or something like that, any of those I would find preferable to a minimum wage, because any of them accomplish the goal of trying to help low-skilled workers without going back and trying to change the incentives, change the messages, change the prices which are out there in the economy. I think the main reason for a minimum wage, the main argument for it these days, is simply to prevent cases of really deep abuse, where you can imagine someone taking advantage of someone with low skill or a recent immigrant and really paying them, you know, 12 cents an hour or something like that. And so it's worth avoiding some cases like that. In that sense, I think a minimum wage can be sort of a safety level where we can avoid terrible things happening. But a higher minimum wage, it seems to me, is just a peculiar and inappropriate way to try and really help low-skilled workers. It doesn't go after the guts of the problem, and it has effects that we aren't going to like as much. Let's move on to a second issue. Let's talk about unions a little bit. Unions are in effect to alter the supply side of the labor market. Instead of having competition between workers where a lot of workers come together and each one's trying to work in such a way that they will, you know, undercut each other, the group of workers is going to hang together and negotiate together. They're going to say, we're a group here. We're not going to say, I'll work for less than he'll work, and he'll work for less than he'll work for, and she'll work for less than either of them. And so as a result, wages will be pushed down. Instead, by standing together, we're going to be able to keep wages high. Now, are unions good or bad? Are they a good thing or a bad thing? It's, of course, what we want to know. And as usual, of course, you would guess that I'm not going to give you an answer to a question like that. But let me give you a couple of facts which I think are illuminating about the role of unions and illuminating about that question to a certain extent. One fact is that there is an extraordinarily wide variation in the force of unions across different countries. In the United States, for example, unions are perhaps 13-14% of the labor force, which is quite low. There are very few countries in the world, developed economies, where unions are that low. On the other hand, in a lot of Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway, unions might be 60, 70, even 80% of the economy, of the workforce. Some countries like Germany or Canada or Italy, United Kingdom, fall kind of in between there. Unions are perhaps 30 or 40% of the workforce in those economies. Now, my point in sort of pointing out this enormous difference across countries is that a lot of those economies around the world have done quite well over the last few decades. I mean, they've done about as well as the U.S. economy, give or take a little bit here or there. I mean, certainly a lot of those economies are developed, rich, first world economies. So, if you're going to say unions are really good, or unions are really bad, you have to come up with some explanation of why it is that there are such an enormous range of differences between unions among economies which have actually done more or less the same. So let's hold that question for a moment. You can come up with a similar question if you look at the U.S. economy and you just look at unionization over time in the U.S. economy. The real burst of unionization in the U.S. economy happens between when the National Labor Relations Act is passed in the 1930s and when the government really encourages unionization sharply during World War II in the early 1940s. And at that point, unionization gets up to where in the U.S. economy, it's about, I believe, 35% or so of the U.S. economy. And since then, since about the early 1950s, the percentage of people who belong to unions in the U.S. has gone down and down and down and down and down and down. In fact, if you just look at private sector unions, you don't look at public sector unions like teachers and government employees, you'll find that unions now represent fewer than 10% of those in the private sector. Now, there's been this long, slow, slow decline in unions over time. If you're going to say unions are really bad, then you should say, this is a wonderful trend for the U.S. economy. This helps explain. Well, what does it help explain exactly? After all, any trend which has been going on for 40 years, we've had good times, we've had bad times, we've had growth, we've had recessions. And through it all, the union forces have just dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. It seems to me not at all obvious to say that unions are good or bad. Their decline has more or less been a constant over a long period of time. So this simple-minded question of, are unions good or bad, is, I think, way too simple a way to think about things. Perhaps it's more accurate to say that unions can be a problem, but clearly they are not always a problem. When could unions be a problem? Well, the sort of unions which would be a difficulty, presumably, would be unions which are really just focused on keeping wages high no matter what, and blocking any kind of change no matter what. That kind of a union is going to lead employers generally to try and shift away from using labor, to hire fewer people, and to just deal as little with the unions as they can. A standard example here of a union that probably fits into this category would be railroad unions in the United States. There's some vivid examples of how peculiar railroad unions have been. In the old days, there were contracts for the workers in railroad unions where they got a bonus for going more than 100 miles in a day. Now, at the time, going 100 miles in a day was quite an achievement because the track was uneven, it went up and down, you could only go maybe 10 miles, 8 miles an hour. Going more than 100 miles in a day was a real sign that the day had gone well. But of course, as trains got faster and faster and the track got better and better, and you began to have 30, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour, going 100 miles in a day was nothing. I mean, that was what you expected to do in about an hour and a half. But thanks to the railroad union, that bonus for that more than 100 miles a day stayed in their contracts for decades and decades and decades. That is not a useful act on the part of the union. That's a sheer grab for money. Another example from the railroad unions, similar start of story, is that for a long time, the union contracts required that there be three people in the cab of any locomotive. And the three people, one I believe was an engineer, one was a person to steer the train, another was the person to stoke the fire from when they put coal into the fire of the locomotive. And you had to have those three people. That was the union contract. Well, they converted over to the sorts of diesel locomotives where they no longer needed someone to put coal in the fire anymore. But by golly, the union contract said there was a third person there with a shovel, and that person stayed there for decades and decades and decades, sitting there on their shovel, not doing a heck of a lot. Now, That's not a useful role for a union. A union which insists on things like keeping people who are doing absolutely nothing on the business or getting bonuses for things which are just the normal course of business is over time going to drive its industry into the ground. And in fact, one of the reasons railroads had such trouble over time was the extraordinarily powerful and recalcitrant unions which did, in a large extent, drive the railroads into the ground in the United States. Flip side of unions, however, it's certainly possible that unions can act in such a way as to help productivity and competitiveness. After all, workers on the shop floor or on the factory floor often are in the best position to know what needs to happen and what needs to change. They're often the people who are really doing the job. They can really see what's going on. They're the people who can move things around and figure out how to do things better. They can also, if management needs to make some tough changes, maybe needs to introduce new technology, needs to retrain everyone, needs to reshuffle old patterns, the union can be a way of getting the workers to help buy into that change so that they all say, okay, we accept that this is necessary, we accept that this is reasonable, and we accept it because people we trust, the union leaders, tell us it's necessary and reasonable. And so we'll go along with this training, we'll study more, we come up to speed better. The standard example here are things like most of the unions in Germany. It seems clear that one of the reasons Germany's economy has done quite well since the end of World War II has been that unions have helped do apprenticeships, they've helped do training, they've helped pull the companies forward, and they've helped create a lot of additional productivity that might not have been there otherwise. So when unions see themselves as representatives for workers who try to improve the productivity of workers and have the workers deserve higher wages because they're more productive, then I think unions can serve an enormously powerful and productive role. When unions, on the other hand, just sort of say, by golly, it's the contract, it's been the contract, we want our money, we don't care what happens to your business, we don't care about whether we're productive, just sign our checks and get out of our faces, that is not productive. And as a general rule, unions that do that will tend to drag down their industries. Now, of course, in most unions, there's kind of a Jekyll and Hyde thing going on here. There's some elements of both of these faces. But as U.S. unions fall below 10% of the private workforce, I think it's fair to say that something is being lost there. And it's something that's a little hard to articulate, perhaps, but one way of thinking of it is that a worker's voice is being lost. And by voice, I don't mean the sort of obstinate, loud, screechy, screamy voice that you can imagine in some unions, but I mean that there are a lot of legitimate worker concerns about things like flexible hours in a time when more and more you have two parents working, about flexible benefits, about daycare, about how do we get retrained, about how do we work with new technology. And that kind of voice on those kinds of issues is somehow not heard, I think, because unions are so small and having such a difficult time. I think the unions have it within their own power to change some of that, but perhaps that involves some changes in their internal thinking as well as changes in what's happening in the world around them. Let's move to a third issue. The third issue is labor market discrimination. How do we think about discrimination in a supply and demand context? Well, the easiest way to think about it is, let's just imagine there's some group we're discriminating against. It could be women, it could be some ethnic group. But because of discrimination, demand for labor from that group is lower than it would otherwise be. At any given wage, people will want to hire fewer folks of that background, or maybe none at all, and as a result, the demand for their labor drops down, and that drives down the wage. Now, it's well known, of course, in the U.S. economy that that blacks and other ethnic minorities and women as well tend to earn less than white men, based even after you adjust for things like education and work background. But It's interesting, I think, to divide up these ideas about discrimination into several different areas, because discrimination is something which doesn't just come in one flavor. It comes in several different forms. And there are some forms of discrimination that the market will fight against. There are other forms of discrimination the market will just put its stamp of approval on. So, first form of discrimination I want to talk about. Let's say that discrimination is that we pay less to people who are women or ethnic minorities, but the reason we pay less to them is because they're less productive workers. And the reason they're less productive workers is because they were discriminated against early in life. They were brought up in poor neighborhoods, they went to bad schools, they didn't have family background and connections to get good job background, good internships, and so by the time they get out there to the labor market, yes, they're less productive workers, they've been discriminated against all their lives, it's not a big shock that they might be less productive. Now, in this case, market wages are just really passing on bad news. They're telling you something about the quality of education and the quality of background that people have had in the past. Now, that something is an unwelcome message. It's an unpleasant message. It's a message we should try and do something about. But it's not clear to me that the right solution for that is to shoot the messenger and try and change people's wages. All the market is telling us then is that, yes, we live in a discriminatory society, and the solutions happen before people start getting jobs. They happen earlier on in life. Of course, the solutions there would be to do better education, better training, remedial education, but it's a very difficult cycle to break. There's no question. And it's not clear that we have, as a society, good ways of doing that, although maybe we could do a little better, more than we do in some cases, maybe a lot more. Second form of discrimination. Let's think about discrimination, which is the way I think most of us think about the term. Let's say there are two people with equal productivity, equal job performance, equal background, but they get different pay. So the woman is paid less, the black person is paid less. Well, the obvious answer there from our society is, well, let's pass laws about equal employment and against discrimination, and if people are paid less, then let them sue, you know, sue those employers. And I have no problem with those laws. But it is interesting to point out, interesting to think that, in that case, we would expect the market to be a powerful force for reducing discrimination. After all, if you're in a situation where someone says, I'm not going to pay you this because, you know, I don't like you, you're worth it. Your productivity's good, but I just don't like you. All you have to do is find someone who doesn't feel that way. In fact, what we could expect to have happen at an extreme is you would expect to have entire firms that hire women or entire firms that hire black folks. Because, after all, if they can hire those people and pay them more than the competitors will, pay them more what they're worth, then you would expect the market to develop those profitable opportunities. So it would be fine in a way in the market if some people were highly discriminatory and never wanted to hire a black person, never wanted to hire a woman. As long as there are some people who are willing to hire them, the market will drive their wages toward their productivity. Now, that's an unpleasant sort of conclusion because it implies that we're sort of letting some discriminators go. We're sort of saying, okay, you're a discriminator, but it doesn't make a big difference at the end of the day. And I think that it's important to separate out, yes, it doesn't make a big difference, maybe economically to the wages of people, but it might still make a difference to society that we don't like people treating other people that way and we want to pass some laws about it. So it's a case where sort of the claims of justice and the claims of economics may not be walking hand in hand. You may want to prevent discrimination because of a claim of justice, but, you know, it may be basically true that once you've done that, then you find that basically people are getting paid more or less what they were getting paid before because the market was preventing discrimination before. So that's kind of a more difficult case than it might seem at first glance. A third possibility. Imagine that instead of having the same job performance and different pay, discrimination takes the form where people are filtered into different jobs. Perhaps women are filtered into what we might call the pink collar ghetto, secretarial jobs, jobs that happen in offices. Men are pushed into blue collar jobs, garbage collection, things like that. And at the end of the day, what we suddenly find is that, strangely enough, many of the women's jobs tend to be low paid and many of the men's jobs tend to be high paid. Well, how do we reconcile that? How do we deal with that? If the discrimination is not happening with identical jobs, but with different jobs, The solution that's been proposed in some cases is called comparable worth. The idea of comparable worth pay would be that we determine how hard jobs are on some sort of a scale, and then once we've determined how much each one should be worth on some sort of scale that might figure in education and background and skills and all those kinds of things, then we just set our pay scales according to that level. And Washington State, for example, some years back set all of its pay levels according to a comparable worth scale that a consultant had figured out for them. Now, in a way, this is attractive. It seems to sort of get at this problem of different jobs, same pay, or different jobs, different pay. But in practice, it causes all sorts of difficulties. What happened in the state of Washington was that women were being paid a lot more, because after all, their jobs were raised by the comparable worth scale. As a result, women never left those jobs, and the pink-collar ghettos stayed almost entirely female. On the other hand, the men's jobs were being paid less because of the comparable worth scale, and as a result of that, the state was having a terrible time hiring men for those jobs or hiring anyone for those jobs. People could get paid more in the private sector. So instead of breaking down the discrimination, getting men into the jobs traditionally held by women, getting women into the jobs traditionally held by men, the comparable worth scales tended to reinforce that discrimination and keep it in place. And it had all the problems you would expect of setting wages and then trying to ignore the market. So I think discrimination laws are clearly something that serve a useful function. I mean, there's strong evidence that the discrimination laws of the 1960s really jarred the U.S. economy, and particularly the South, in such a way that they dramatically helped wages for blacks. There's interesting evidence today that single women without kids, that is, actually do quite well in the labor market, about as well as men. However, there's also evidence that black folks continue to earn less than white people with similar background, and women with kids tend to earn less than people with no kids, than men or than women with no kids. So there's clearly some space to go and some distance to go there, and it seems unlikely that the market forces are really wiping out discrimination to the extent that we would like them to. Final set of issues. Many of you obviously thought, well, when we're thinking about wages are clearly part of what you get paid, but you also get paid benefits. Wages aren't everything. After all, you get paid benefits as well. And in fact, benefits can be quite substantial. By the time you think in vacation benefits, retirement, health, disability, all those different kinds of things, and you add them all up, it's presently true that for every dollar of total compensation someone receives, about 72 cents is in wages, and the other 28 cents is in the form of the value of the benefits that they receive. In fact, over the last 10 years or so, it's typically been true that the costs for compensation, like health insurance and Social Security benefits, have been going up and up. But the amount that you get paid in wages has not been going up nearly as much. In effect, when you get your raise, you're getting it in the form of more retirement and health benefits. You're not getting it in the form of higher wages. Now, what's interesting about this is if you think about it from the firm's point of view, remember, the firm is paying people according to productivity and according to their output. The firm, frankly, doesn't care whether it pays you money in the form of wages or whether it pays you money in the form of benefits. I mean, a dollar is a dollar as far as the firm is concerned. So since the firm doesn't care, it's just going to pay a certain amount based on productivity. It seems true to most economists that at the end of the day, the employee is the one who ends up paying for all those benefits. You might say, for example, I negotiated for higher health care benefits at work. Great, that's fine, but the next few years, your wage doesn't go up as much as it otherwise would. What effectively happens is you got your wage, you got your extra compensation, but it came in a particular form. Now, this idea that even when employers provide benefits, it actually comes out of the employee's wages, is an idea that has some unpleasant implications. And it sort of forces us once again to think about trade-offs and things like that. It's really common, I think, to hear people say, well, you know, the employer pays half my Social Security benefits. Let's have the employer pay more of my Social Security benefits. Or the employer pays for my health care benefits. Let's have the employer provide more of health care benefits. Or let's have the employer provide daycare. Let's have the employer provide training. Let's have the employer provide whatever. The implication always being, the employer pays for that, I don't. It's coming out of the employer's pocket, not my pocket. Well, remember, the employer just pays for productivity. The employer isn't going to pay more. The market won't let them pay more. They can't overpay, or they'll go out of business. So as we sort of load more and more things on the employer, that just comes out of our wages on the other side. And most folks believe, most economists believe, that every time we talk about an employer-paid benefit, what we're really talking about is something which in the end comes out of the employee's wages. It's just that the employer is signing the check. I sometimes think it would be helpful and interesting to see what would happen if we designed a little experiment. And the experiment would be that on your paycheck, along with the taxes you pay, it also listed the amount that your vacation was worth, the amount that your health insurance was worth, the amount that your disability coverage was worth, the amount that all the other benefits were worth. And then at the end, it gave total compensation. If that were to happen, I wonder if people would still be as supportive of having the employer pay health care benefits as they are right now, or if people would perceive it in the way they perceive taxes and say, that tax is coming out of my paycheck. Because just as the tax is coming out of your paycheck, so too are all those benefits that seem so attractive.